Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, no matter where you're listening, around the world, this is Sedona Talk Radio.
To Pandora's Box. This is Kalia, and today is Tuesday, July 14th, 2015. And we are in part 7 of the series From Self-Loathing to Self-Loving. The topic of our show today is loving yourself when you feel hated. And our guest, which is a rare occasion for me these days, is psychologist Ernie Vecchio. Welcome, Ernie.
Thank you, and well, it's great to be here, Kalia. I love being on the show with you. It's, you know, it's always fun, and I love your topics. And I said before in the past that I love how you stay true to your mission of narcissism and its effect on others.
Thank you. And just to mention for you listeners that showed up last week and were surprised by us going immediately off air. I had a storm here where I am in Arizona last week and my internet went down. So I was kind of hands tied and could not resume the show. And today, Ernie, you're having a storm.
Yes. I lost my power and I was in before. I'm sitting here in candlelight on a cell phone.
So you're having a candlelight conversation with us today.
Absolutely. Having a candlelight conversation with my dog sitting here on top of me. So yeah.
And a storm in the background. So
we will
pray for the best today and hope we can get through this show. It's a great topic. So many of my show topics come from what my counseling clients are struggling with. As Ernie says, you know, that the narcissistic abuse is a real common theme that I work with. And one thing I really work with people on is finding greater self-love. Since the majority of my clients are emerging from relationships with narcissistic or other toxic types of partners, there's been a lot of character assassination, abuse, negative projection, and devaluing. And although some of my clients are normally, you know, strong, independent, confident people, the relationship has taken a toll on their confidence. In toxic and dysfunctional family systems, work environments, relationships, and social groups, we often find the projection of self-loathing onto the people who love them the most. Often our reward for loving is being scapegoated and hated. It's not that we're actually doing something to cause such projection. We're simply in a toxic system where projection is the coping mechanism of the person who can't see deep enough into his or her own psyche to see what the problem is coming from within. Of course, projection is common amongst all people, but it seems to be very much exaggerated in personality disorders like borderline personality and narcissism. It's common amongst narcissists, borderlines, bipolar people, and addicts to disown the shadow and project it outward onto those who are typically mirroring or reflecting the shadow. So some of the most loving, empathic, and caring people can be the clearest mirrors for another shadow. Sometimes the most sensitive souls are the strongest targets for abuse. And this is because their sensitivity comes up against the insensitive nature of the disordered individual and often is perceived as weakness or a threat and becomes a target. If you're on the receiving end of a loved one's projections, it isn't an easy place to be. In fact, it can be quite crazy-making. You may be blamed for everything that's happening in your relationship with that person, or worse yet, everything negative in that person's life. And if you're the kind of person who does self-reflect, you might ask yourself if those accusations are true in some way. You may actually take on the responsibility for the issues in the relationship, or you try to get that person to see his or her part in the play. When you do, you're met with hostility, anger, rage, or further attack. People who are masters at projection have developed the sophisticated defense mechanism to protect them from a deeper truth that would destroy their current perceived reality and self-opinion. We all want to see ourselves as good, lovable, and acceptable. But for some, the only way they can see self as good is to disown their bad behavior and project it outward, making someone else out to be the bad guy. With narcissistic abuse, the ones on the receiving end of the abuse are targeted, and a whole mess of dark imaginings are projected onto them. A case is built up against them, and others are recruited in the character assassination of the innocent party. I've heard so many people tell me, my entire social group, my friends, and my family have been seduced by this person whom I loved and trusted, and they all think I'm crazy. I'm hated by everyone. And this is actually a typical scenario. It can be extremely painful to be the scapegoat, the target for character assassination. There's often no way to communicate one's innocence. And when you're feeling crazy, as a result of years of crazy-making behavior, you may appear a bit unstable to those closest to you. And when the sweet-talking, charming, charismatic, and seductive loved one comes along, talking about how you're just not making sense anymore, and how they fear you're unstable, perhaps an emotional basket case, and not being rational or logical, the loved ones often believe there's something wrong with you, especially when they have witnessed firsthand how you're just not yourself. When you find yourself the target for character assassination, dark projections, and punishing, vengeful behavior, it can be easy to assume you've done something to deserve it. It can be easy to feel you're somehow at fault. It can be easy to feel that you really are going mad. It's gaslighting behavior at its best. You receive very little, if any, validation for your goodness and worthiness. But even if you receive some validation from others, the validation that is most desired is from the very person who is projecting negativity onto you. It can be very difficult to work through deep feelings of worthlessness and self-loathing when you're being blamed, devalued, and discarded by the ones you love the most. So the topic for the show, the question is, how do you love yourself when you're feeling so hated? So I'm going to invite Ernie on board to explore this topic with me. So once again, welcome, Ernie. And what are your thoughts about this topic?
Well, the first thing that, you know, as you were talking, there's a couple of things that came to my mind. One is that, you know, a long time ago, we talked about the narcissist myth and the character of Echo in that myth, and that Echo's job is to parrot the voice of narcissists, who at the time is a god in this garden, and he isn't aware that anybody's in the garden with him. And so I was thinking of what you were saying about that, you know, that if you don't echo the voice of the person that you're connected with that has this disorder, then you are an outcast, because mm-hmm. that is your job, is to echo that. And if not, then you literally are kicked out of the garden, so to speak. So that's one thing that came to mind. It reminded me of that conversation that we had. But the other thing is that when I think of self-love and what it means, so many people don't really know what self-love is, because it sounds egoic just in the saying of the word self-love. Mm-hmm. You know, in therapy and in counseling, we learn about self-esteem and self-worth and self-confidence, but self-love is an enigma to a lot of people. And I've learned over time and with my own work that it's combining compassion with mercy. And so many people know what compassion is. They don't have a sense of mercy, what mercy is. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on mercy. As it relates to this topic tonight. Have you ever thought about the definition of mercy or what mercy might be?
You know, I really haven't. I'm really excited that you're bringing this up so that we can explore it. Of course, compassion and self-compassion I talk about a lot. But, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is, you know, I've got this statue of the goddess Kuan Yin, who is the goddess of mercy, who hears the cries of the world. And I think about this, she's been kind of an icon in my life. She's been here as a statue for in my life for like 20 years now. And just reminding me that oftentimes, you know, that we cry out for mercy, but are we really talking about being merciful to ourselves?
Yeah, and most people, again, they think it's, they know it's a derivative or it's kind of a subcategory of compassion. But remember, compassion for a lot of people, and one of the new things that I found in working with trauma is that most people define compassion as suffering for the self, when in fact it's suffering with. So that's the key thing. So first you have to know the true definition of compassion, which is to suffer with oneself, to hold oneself in the moment and allow whatever's going to come through to come through in that adversity, whatever it might be. And then the next layer and the deeper layer is the mercy piece. And so as I was finding out that people had trouble with the definition of mercy, what I did is I came up with a real life example of what it is in life. And you've probably never ever had a file or anything on you or a folder on you, but I have as a previous juvenile. I used to be in the court system, and so I used to have a folder. And so what I've said to people is that if you went into a courtroom, and this is fascinating, Kaylee, this is really what happens. If you're in a courtroom or in a court of law and you decide that you want your life to be reviewed because you feel like that the sentence that you've been given by your life is not just or not fair, and you've got two judges to choose from, you've got the wrathful, unforgiving judge and you have the compassionate judge, what I've learned is that 95% of the population walks into the wrathful judge with that folder. And what it's called when you actually go into a court of law and ask somebody to review your life story, it's an appeal. You're asking for an appeal. And so as you appeal your life story and your circumstances, and then you walk into the wrathful judge, what do you think he says? He says, you know, stop your crying and go back to your cell and put your time in. And that's where we are with that. So people get stuck as they try to appeal their life, try to look at their life with a different context, take a different perspective of their circumstances, and they go to a judge, and that judge symbolically is the ego. So 95% of us walk into the ego and say, "What do you think? Can I get an appeal?" And the ego will say, "No, go back to your life and stop your crying and put your tie in." The interesting part is if you go into the compassionate judge, he opens up the folder, he looks at your life story and looks at the suffering you've been through, and he says something pretty amazing. He says, "You know what? The punishment doesn't fit the crime." He takes the gavel, hits it on the bench, and says, "Free for time served." In a court of law, that is what mercy is. So when you think of mercy, think of it that way. That first of all, it's self-love is a combination of being able to suffer with oneself and also setting yourself free for time served.
And the idea of suffering with oneself, though, a lot of people may not understand that concept of, you know, either suffering for oneself or with oneself. You know, when you're talking about suffering with oneself, you're talking about being present with yourself while you are suffering.
Absolutely. And allowing the suffering and the adversity to bring to you whatever it's going to bring. In other words, from that position, from the soul's perspective, from that position of observer, from a neutral place, you allow the suffering to bring to you whatever it's going to bring to you. And rather than suffering for yourself as victim, you suffer with yourself and end up transforming. And so I guess the way to say it is that what you're doing in this business of self-love, particularly when you are kind of undergoing adversity or trauma of some sort, and you are staying with it to see what it's going to bring you, you're attempting to purge old versions and old identities of who you thought you were. So there's a purging mm-hmm. component. That's really what it means when you suffer with yourself. You're really attempting to have, unconsciously, you're attempting to have a catharsis. That's really what it is. I mean, when you think about ego death in general, and when you think about personality disorder being repaired, the only way that personality disorder is repaired is to kill off the ego. And the only thing that kills it off is adversity and suffering. And that's if you're awake, you're conscious, and you're taking responsibility for what that experience is bringing you. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's the way I see it, that it's a purging of old identities and old ideas of who you think you are. And that purging is not possible if you're swimming in victimization. It's only
right.
possible, it's only possible if you're actually seeing the benefit, getting the lesson and the wisdom of that adversity, whatever it's bringing you, and then a purging happens. And that really is the death and rebirth process in spiritual work. I mean, and so if you're growing in spiritual work, then you're kind of undergoing really kind of countless ego deaths. And I think I've said this to you before in previous shows, I don't think we're ready as human beings to even begin that process until we hit midlife. I think midlife is when it really hits us.
Which is interesting. That's most of my client load are in midlife. Most. I am getting some wise young people coming to me, but most of them are midlife, and they have experienced and suffered enough that they're finally kind of brought to this death's doorway. And you're talking about the ego, which I think is really important to explore, because as you said, personality disorders are rooted in the ego. If there's no ego, there's no personality disorder.
It's considered ego dysfunction, and that's really what ego dysfunction is. I mean, the ego, I mean, a lot of people think the ego is bad and we should be rid of ego. And the truth of the matter is, it's got to be suffered awake, the ego, which means in a different way, if you say it in a different way, it's got to be pulled into the present. And so mm-hmm. in my sense of it is the human spirit or the feeling self, that part of the self that's connected to the reaction of real time and present time, the function of the human spirit is to provoke the ego into some kind of action. And it's either to provoke it into doing what it's always done or to provoke it to awaken. And so, and we're not going to walk into that consciously. And so it typically happens, you know, a lot of people say, and I know you've experienced this too, you know, but what do I do? What do I do? And what you end up discovering is that it's a bunch of stuff you need to stop doing. It isn't as much about doing as it is letting go of these identifications that you think define you, because that is where the pain is coming from. And
right. And I think it's important also to acknowledge that that when you find yourself, I was really careful not to use the word victim here, because I agree with you that we don't have very much healing at all. There's a time for feeling victimized, but we don't have very much healing when we see ourselves as a victim. So when I was talking about the target for character assassination, I didn't say the victim, I said the target, just to bring that to people's attention, that the other aspect is that people can project all they want onto you. They can project the most horrific, ugly, obscene things upon you. And if you don't have a core shame that is kind of sticky, if you don't have some beliefs about yourself that there's something inherently flawed with you or there's something bad or wrong with you, then these projections absolutely have nowhere to stick.
Absolutely. That's very well said, because that's the truth. I mean, the reason that personality disorder is so epidemic and no healing is happening is because most of the therapies that are happening, in at least in social work and counseling and psychology and psychiatry, it's about restructuring the ego, rethinking the ego, parenting the ego. It isn't about holding the ego in a cathartic moment, which is the concept of the inner child. I mean, you're not going to be able to take this handicapped, deformed child, which really is nothing but a shapeshifter anyway, and that deformity is nothing but the self that was formed out of self-defense. And so you're not going to heal that unless you hold that child in all of its deformities and not allow any of that stuff to hit it. And you're right, if projection only works as a defense mechanism that other people use against us, if it has some place to stick.
And I should also qualify for the listeners that, Ernie, you often say that you believe that all people are personality disordered because they all are divided against themselves. They all have a dysfunctional relationship with themselves.
Right. In my estimation, we're all personality disorders in recovery. I mean, every one of us that are paying attention. And because there's three categories, and I don't mean titles or labels like in the DSM-4 or 5, whatever's out there now, we have all the categories of personality disorder, but there's actually just three kinds. There's the kind that's guilt-driven, that's divided against the self, the kind that's shame-driven, that's divided against the culture, and then the third kind would be somebody who has a little bit of both. And so shame is typically the one right now that's dominant in the culture, and the compensation for shame is narcissism. The compensation for guilt was religiosity. And that shift happened, and I watched it happen in the culture around 1980. So from 1980 up to the present, shame has taken over at a very, very high level. And the compensation, of course, isn't working. And when you look at the number one cause of death right now in this country for people between the ages of 15 and 34, it's suicide.
There's more and more suicide. Yeah, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, and these are shame-driven cases, shame-driven problems, because that generation was born in 1980 up to the present. Well, I think 1980 to 1996 or 98, something like that. But it's a bunch of people. And so shame has taken over again at a different level. I don't know that shame was really, we all grow up with guilt and shame at some level in the culture, but I think it's more prominent now than it's ever been. And so that's one thing that came to my mind about this business from self-loathing to self-love. The other part is that, and I don't know if you agree with me on this, but I think there's a certain amount of humility that comes with valid self-love. In other words, I think of the swan story and the duckling, where the duck is born into the swan's born into a duck family, but doesn't know it's a swan, and literally grows up and takes all the abuse that comes with being a misfit in that particular family or culture, and then goes out into the wilderness and then ends up being alone and sees these swans fly over, and I just wish I could be like these people. There's a scene in the story of the duckling where he comes out in the spring of his adolescent years, probably 17, 18 years of age, and he sees the swan on the lake. And as he's swimming towards them, he's so taken by his beauty or by their beauty that he puts his head beneath his wing and he sees his reflection in the water. He's a swan just like them. So I think that putting your head beneath your wing, that humbling sensation, is another piece of self-love. It isn't narcissistic, and I think that's the confusion for folks. When they hear self-love, it sounds egoic, when actually,
and yet narcissism isn't self-love. There's no self-love, really.
Not at all. That's grandiosity built on. Yeah, right. That's grandiosity built on a foundation of an enormous amount of insecurity. Yeah, there's nothing.
Yeah,
real
and
about
I see,
it, but they have no.
I agree that there is a certain amount of humility in self-love. There is, there's also, developing compassion once again for yourself, for what you're going through, for your suffering, for your difficulties in life, developing a different relationship with your inner judge. We talk about the judge, if we can. I had a whole episode on the inner judge and about assigning our inner judge.
Well, now they go into that courtroom all the time. I mean, that's what most people do. When they go into the inner judge, they go to the wrong one.
they go to the wrong one. And so in my episode, it was like assigning that wrathful judge a new role, you know, and what a beautiful role to assign it as the compassionate judge, as the judge that that says, okay, you've gone through a lot here. I'm releasing you for time served. You know, you've paid your price. You're free now. You can go out into the world and live your life differently. And you know, I know I've gone through this. I just want to say this. I know I've gone through this, and a lot of my clients have, where you look at your history of like attracting dysfunctional, toxic relationships and go, I'm just a loser. I'm just incapable of having anything good in my life. And if you can take that perspective of the judge that sets you free for time served, you can see that up until this point, I've made some choices that weren't healthy, but I've been set free now. And if you can really look at your life that way.
Yeah, and if you want an image for that, I mean, I ask people all the time, well, there's a couple things that I do almost every day of my job, and that is I give the vocabulary portion of an intelligence test as part of the psychological examination that I do. And one of the words that people are asked to define is compassion. And so many people define it as loving somebody, caring for somebody, having strong feelings for somebody, but they don't, which is a one-point response. A two-point response is to have empathy and sympathy for another human being, to be able to put yourself in the shoes of another person. It isn't carrying the suffering for them. And so many people define compassion is carrying the suffering of others. And so this comes out of Christianity. I mean, the concept of that, the martyrdom and the sacrifice that people believe that compassion is, comes out of the distortion that Christ died for us, when in actuality Christ died with us, and that idea of martyrdom is the reason why when people do suicide, they end up shooting other people, then they shoot themselves. The idea is, you won't know me in life, but you'll know me in death. And so the martyrdom sacrifice piece is what a lot of people think compassion is, that they're supposed to sacrifice and martyr themselves for this other person. And if you're connected with a narcissistic person, you're really working uphill on that, because there's not enough sacrifice you could possibly do that's going to work. And
I think a lot of people make the mistake of believing that person's actually going to see or recognize their suffering and their challenges, right, and have compassion for them, and that will never happen.
Another thing that's kind of curious, Kaylee, is that I will ask people to point on their body where they think the human compass is. And again, 85-90% of the population points to their head and says the brain is the compass.
Oh, wow.
When in actuality, the heart is the compass. And so,
of course,
this is the thing. Yeah. And so you say, of course, I say, of course, but most people don't imagine the heart is the compass. They think the brain is. And this is, again, part of the problem, which is where the ego resides. So they're literally pointing to the ego. The ego resides in the left hemisphere of the brain. If you want to know where it's located, that's where it is. And so people point to the ego and say the ego is the compass. And they say that kind of innocently, because it is an adaptive function. In other words, we need the ego to get to work on time, to brush our teeth, to take a shower, to manage the outside external world. But when it comes to our internal life, the heart is the compass. And so,
yes.
And so I say all the time in my work that because the ego has been made the default compass, people don't trust their hearts, or they think their compass is broken. And so I tell them, all they got to do is just tap on the glass, their needle stuck. That's what I say to people all the time.
Well, and another problem with the heart, though, that I see all the time is that people are confused about their heart and the messages that their heart are giving them, especially when you bring in compassion and empathy, which are considered to be qualities of the heart. You know, they're qualities of love and caring and, you know, ability to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. And when someone has over-empathized with perhaps the narcissist in their life, or has such compassion for the suffering of that person, because they can often see that person is in pain and is suffering in some way, that that they're constantly pulled to that person, even when it's not good for them, even when it's not healthy for them. And so they say, my heart has betrayed me, or my heart has misled me.
Are you there? Did I lose you?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Are you there? Something
can you
happen.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah, okay. There was like a crash or something just happened. I thought I lost you.
Oh, okay. Yep. So did you hear what I was saying, that people feel that
yes.
their heart has betrayed them or has misled them?
Yeah, and I think that lack of trust in one's heart gets back to that stickiness that you're talking about, that mm-hmm. if you look at the definition of guilt is I made a mistake, and shame is I am a mistake. That's the stickiness. That if you feel that you are a mistake, which is a shame-driven concept, then you're not one that's going to have a lot of experience at trusting your heart. And so I think a lot of times when they say their heart has failed them, they really weren't operating out of their hearts, not because the heart, because they felt like a mistake to begin with. The idea is if I can fix somebody, then I'm automatically somehow fixing myself, and that's just not the way it works.
Well, it's pretty typical, though, that we mm-hmm. do that. That okay, I've got this wound inside of myself, and I don't feel so wounded, or I don't feel so alone when I can try to fix other people. In fact, is that not also something that stems from our not just Christian belief system, but our religious belief systems across the world is don't focus on yourself, serve others.
Right, right.
Be selfless
yeah,
serving.
Yeah, and if you can't, right, and if you can't love, and you're supposed to love others as you love yourself, but if you don't love yourself, how do you do that, you know? And
right.
So what we're typically taught is externalize it so you can see it. And then, you know, by your good works and your good deeds, by your martyrdom and by your sacrifice, then you must be worthy in that respect. And so, again, it's, when you look at some of the older interpretations of the Christ concept, he was considered a wounded healer. I forget what author wrote this, but somebody was asking, you know, how would I be able to find Christ in the village? And they said, well, he'll be in the middle of the square unwrapping his wounds and wrapping his wounds while he is helping somebody else. He is a wounded healer. Well, the idea being that before you can fix anybody else, you have to be in the process of fixing yourself. And you have to have achieved that at some level. And so that this is the problem. This is why there's no healing going on, because it's no secret that many of the people that are in mental health and that do mental health work are broken. And you know, I used to say when I was teaching at the graduate level that there was two kind of people in this profession, people that were seeking their own healing and chasing their own tails, and people that were hiding in the profession. And I think, and I'm not saying that they're doing that consciously. I think it's an unconscious.
Of course not. Right.
They're hiding unconsciously in the very profession that they're practicing, and not realizing that if you can't wear the very stuff that you're teaching, if you can't apply it to yourself, then how can you possibly teach it to me? And so so this again is why the healing isn't happening, at least in the mental health model.
In the mental health model, and any kind of traditional educational system,
mm-hmm.
there it's an intellectual process. It's not an inside process. So there isn't the inner work isn't part of that training. And if someone is a true healer, they're going to be doing their inner work while accomplishing their educational degrees. They're going to be doing their inner work.
Well,
and
that's an important point, Kayla, that self-love is not intellectual. It isn't cognitive. It is a
no.
sensation. people, you know, people don't understand, I think, you know, because people that have shame as a demon, I can speak to that personally, the concept of self-love to me was foreign. I couldn't imagine what it would feel like to experience self-love. And so, and I couldn't imagine it cognitively at all, what it would be, because it felt artificial and fake to me at some intellectual level. So I did not know at the time I was seeking an understanding of self-love, that I was in pursuit of a sensation. And when I spoke with a mentor and a teacher about that, he said a very curious thing to me. He said, well, you may not put so much emphasis on trying to find self-love. It's paying more attention to your longing for it. And that longing, I think, is the angst of the human condition in general. You know, we all long for someone to see us, to recognize people, you know, to be able to see us at some point. I think that was in the Avatar movie. They said, I love you in that movie by saying, I see you.
Yes.
I think that's it. I think that's it. I think that many of us long to be seen, to be recognized for who we are and what we are and how we are, without the artificial projections of the ego. And that is the spiritual process and the spiritual undertaking when one goes after that, the sensation of it. And so self-loathing is because it is shame-driven, it was given to you. It wasn't anything that you did, it's something you inherited. And
yes.
That stickiness that you described, as far as I'm concerned, you came into the world, you know, with a clean slate at some level, and you acquired that stickiness through your early beginnings, and it felt like truth, and so you hung on to it, only to find out later that it wasn't. So it's.
And I think that's really important to know is for people is that when you're feeling really horrible about yourself. And you believe it's because this outside entity is making you feel that way. Sure, that outside entity is contributing to the way that you're feeling by throwing these projections at you. But once again, those projections, I'd like to use the example of if somebody came up to you and said, you know, you really have ugly green hair. And, you know, it's like, well, I don't have green hair. You know you don't have green hair. That you don't have a charge. There's no stickiness.
Right.
And you're more likely to think that that person's a little nutso. But if somebody comes up and says, you know, you're just really ugly. And you've got this this piece in you that maybe a parent or something told you you were ugly or you were shamed, you know, a lot as a child, and that was one of your wounds, that it's going to stick. It's got glue. It's got something to stick to. So you've got ugly green hair has nowhere to go, but you're ugly. You're not going to look at that person and go, wow, you're nuts.
That's where the phrase comes. It takes one to know one. One of the classic lines that I love is when a personality disordered person meets another individual and in some snide way says that person's got a personality problem, they really are describing that they recognize dysfunction in another human being because they have it. And that's the flip side of projection, that if you pay attention to your own projections, and not just be on the receiving end of a projection, but pay attention to your own projections, then you can begin to realize that a lot of the stuff that you see in individuals, you can only see it because you possess some of it, whatever it may be. And that's why I say everybody has disorder, because at some level we all get cut away from who we are in the beginning and spend the rest of our lives trying to get back to some authentic version of ourselves. And that cutting away experience happens. It doesn't have to be like my experience where it was a stake through the heart. It could be a subtle, it could be years of tiny things that just say, just prove over and over again that somehow shame is your demon. But self-loathing is something that is given to you and is taught to you over time. And as you become an adult and begin to have relationships as an adult, then it's very easy for people to project stuff onto that. And so knowing where you stop and start and where the other person stops and starts a key piece of that relationship issue. So to me, it isn't just the projections of others that are being put on you. It's also paying attention to your own projections, because if you're defending yourself at all, you are projecting at some level. And because it's a normal defense mechanism, and it's typically not in your awareness, most people are not aware of their projections.
That is really interesting that most people are not aware of their projections. So that is part of the healing process, is to become aware of what we are projecting out onto the world. I mean, it is taught pretty commonly out there now in personal and spiritual growth circles that, you know, what you accuse somebody else of doing, you might want to look at as coming from within yourself.
What comes to mind for me is just like counseling 101. But I don't know if you remember, if you've ever seen the somebody draw like a pie, like a circle, and have one piece cut out of that circle that's shaped like a pie piece, and you're doing relationship work with this person, and you're looking at them and saying, on a scale from 1 to 10, where would you put your self-esteem and your self-worth? And they say, well, I'm a 5-6 or a 4-5. And you say, what is your partner? And they would say, oh, he would say he's an 8-9 or a 9-10. And so what you have to tell them is that, well, 9-10s don't hang around with 4-5s, first of all. These numbers are made up, but 9-10s don't hang around with 4-5s. And so at a max, the person that you're hanging out with is a 4-5 just like you. And so that's a wonderful example of projection. I mean, people think that their partners are the missing piece, that if they are combined with that person, that they are a secure 10 on that 1 to 10 scale, and that person makes up the difference because it is that we're lacking, and that missing piece is inside of us. It isn't outside of us. And so it's
right.
Done. And again, that's another projection of self-loathing. And
That's a good example also of what we often do in meeting someone who is highly narcissistic, that is, seems to have a lot of self-confidence, because that can be the facade, the mask.
Yeah, look what's happening right now in the culture with Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump right now is getting an enormous amount of press for being a jackass. And I think, and what's funny about that is that there's actually people that are worried that he's gonna win. And I mean, if you want evidence, narcissism has taken over this culture. If Donald Trump wins this election, then absolutely narcissism is in charge of this culture, because you couldn't find a more wonderful symbol for narcissism than Donald Trump.
No, there you go.
And people are excited about the idea, because he's saying and doing things they wish they could say and do. They find it at some level disgusting and off color and wrong and whatever. But at the same time, they're attracted to him being so brazen with what he's doing. And that's narcissism at its finest.
That we look at it that way, that, you know, in the definition of narcissism too, you find a strong self-loathing and shame at the core. And yet you're talking about people that present as exceptionally confident, arrogant, full of themselves. They can do no wrong.
Yeah. Could you imagine Trump admitting that he has self-loathing? Like, not in a million years. He's absolutely in love with himself. And again, we have a massive amount of people that find him an attractive candidate simply for the narcissism that he is portraying. And that's a wonderful example of what's going on in the culture.
Well, it shows how dysfunctional our culture is.
Yes.
That we cannot, that we want to buy the illusion instead of the truth. And yet the hunger you talked about earlier, the longing, the hunger, I see it as, you know, yes, that longing, you know, to be seen, to be heard, to be valued for the authentic being that you are, that is the awakening soul. That longing is what drives us to awaken to our true self. And yet when we go through this process of awakening to our true self, we are really turning away from that illusion that is so popular in our culture, the reality TV and you know, finding people like Donald Trump admiring him so much, mm-hmm. having so much admiration for somebody like that.
Well, and being disgusted at the same time. That's the irony. I mean, we are attracted and disgusted simultaneously at him. And that's the way narcissism mm-hmm. works. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon, really, how big and huge it is in the culture, and which is why I say again that we are a culture of personality disorder, because so few people understand why they are so attracted to the Donald Trumps. They don't really understand what is it about him that excites them. You know, if they understood it, they would be detested by it at some level. But this is the culture.
Well, it is the dysfunctional culture. I believe that there's an awakening thread. There's an awakening element in our world. And the more that I myself start to wake up to my truth, to wake up from the illusion, to see my own beautiful qualities and see the beautiful qualities in others and attract more people who are true and real into my life. The further and further I get away from the lie. So I think we either buy into the truth or we buy into the lie.
Yeah. Well, you know me, I think that love and truth and freedom is a physical dimension that one chooses to live inside of. It isn't a thought or a concept. It's a physical place. And I think the more you spend time in that dimension of love and truth and freedom, which to me are all the same thing said differently, that you begin to become, you know, less and less able to be in the world that we're describing. And this is the challenge in spiritual work. I just did a show here last week or this week on being in the world but not of the world. And I think part of that challenge is that anything that is within your view, that is external, that is impacting you, then that is in the world. Anything that is invisible and that is in the source of its power is your faith and your experience, then it's invisible. And so spiritual people tend to have faith in that invisible dimension of love and truth and freedom more than they do the external, because the external is, as you said, is full of all these illusions. And I was saying before, that's why I like the Wizard of Oz. I mean, the idea of the curtain coming down and seeing the guy behind the curtain pulling the levers. I mean, in spiritual work, how many curtains have to come down, Kalia, before you finally get to a place of saying, wow, enough with the curtains already?
You know? And that's right, really what happens. Right. Yeah. Another thing that I think about when you talk about the Wizard of Oz is, and it takes me to some work that I do with people in my counseling or healing work, is that we often assign people, just like we assign, you know, maybe our partner as a 9 or 10 and the confidence in ourselves as a 4 or a 5. We also can assign people that are intimidating, maybe even bullying, because I run into that a lot in my work, where people come to me with a bullying boss or somebody in their life that's very intimidating, whether it's a partner or somebody else. And that person seems so big and powerful to them, just like the Wizard of Oz, you know, behind the curtain. He's so big and powerful. But when you go behind the curtain, there's this little man, you know, this little man that's trying to pretend that he's big and powerful with all the bells and whistles. And so what I do in hypnosis is actually help people to see the little man or the little woman behind the big, all-powerful facade. I mean, if you could see Donald Trump going home at night and breaking down and sobbing like a little baby and saying, I'm a fraud, I'm a fraud, I'm a fraud, somebody's going to find out.
Oh my God, they're going to see through me.
yeah, which is the worst fear of a narcissist or a sociopath.
Absolutely.
You know, that we would be able to see behind the curtain and see that this person isn't as he seems or she seems. And it helps those of us who are intimidated by these outer characters in our life to feel more powerful in ourselves, to realize, no, you know what? I've given this person power over me. I've put this person up on a pedestal. I believe this person has more power than I do in my life.
And look at the phrase that Dorothy confronts him for scaring the scarecrow and the lion and the Tin Man, she says, you know, what you did was just awful, and why'd you do this? And his response is really very cool. He says, I just showed them what they wanted to see. And that, you know, that's literally what the guy behind the curtain does. He shows us what we want, what we think we want to see, and sells us the illusion. So it's, yeah, fascinating dilemma.
We're always wanting to believe in this power outside of ourselves. And if we could just bring it back home, that's part, you know, we're kind of running out of time, but that's part of this whole process of loving yourself when you feel hated is realize that the true feeling of being hated comes from within of us. It comes from within us. It comes from that shame.
When you say that, I want to say pay attention to the hater, you know, because the person that's doing the hating is has got a lot more issues than the one that's being hated.
Right. Yeah, that too. But just being able to eliminate that self-hatred will give it no place to stick. And that's the one thing that I know, because I grew up with a lot of self-loathing. That was something I've had to overcome. Didn't realize it was there like most people. I thought I was a confident person. I thought I was a strong person. But then I kept coming up against this. And boy, did the projections of others have a lot of sticking power in my life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and being a being a sensitive person, I was a target a lot throughout my life as a child and an adult. And so as I start really working on the inside and really, really starting to see myself on another level and value myself on another level, when people throw eggs at me, my response is different than it used to be. You know, it used to be, well, I must be deserving of having eggs thrown at me. And now it's like, look at that poor person throwing eggs. You know, he must have a lot going on, you know?
Yeah, right. There's nothing.
And that's kind of what we have to do. We have to kind of switch gears to where, you know, having an egg thrown at you that, you know, that's just symbolic, but having an egg thrown at you is no indication of what you deserve or what you're worth. Sometimes we're simply in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I think it's certainly good to realize that what the ego does, I remind people, I don't know if you ever did this when you were in elementary school or junior high school, where you used to write notes in class and you would put a mirror up to the letters that you're writing, then you would reverse the letters. And the only way you could read the note would be if you actually showed the note or reflected the note into a mirror. You'd only be able to read it if you had a mirror handy. This is what the ego does. If you can invert what the ego is doing, then you're going to get what's really happening, rather than that distorted reflection, whatever it may be. And that's, I mean, I jokingly used to think I had 3 sixes on the head, up and find out it was 3 nines. And I think you have to, yeah, I mean, you've got to play with that and understand that that the ego is constantly, its job is to constantly invert or distort what it is that's in front of you. And so what you need to do is reflect it back and figure out some way to convert it to what's really happening. And again, that, you know, people that have self-loathing, that's difficult, because I certainly used to think if it was shame on you or shame on me, it was always shame on me.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a lifetime to get past that. But yeah.
But it's possible. Hey, I think that's an important thing to leave everybody with here, is that it is
absolutely,
truly, truly, truly possible, because you and I are living testaments to that, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Not only is it possible, I don't think the human spirit will let you rest until you fix it. I mean, that's really the way what I think about it. This is that the provocation of the spirit or the human spirit, which is for the soul to get here and to be, for you to be present and for you to self-express, whatever that is, whatever the essence of you is, that, I mean, you're driven by that. It's like I say all the time that people know what's driving them. They have no sense of what's pulling them. Well, once you get a sense of what's pulling you, which is that longing to just simply be and to be seen as the essence of whatever that is, that longing is always there. So I think we're all driven. So not only is it possible, I think if you don't fix it, that the angst is there reminding you of it all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is really no rest or peace. And I just think back of where I was 20 years ago and where I am now. And I had no peace back then. Now, you know, it's not that my life is perfect and I don't have challenges. I have some big challenges that come along, you know, in my life. But it's how we deal with the challenges that come along. It's not that I don't get upset, you know.
Well, and I think they grow you now rather than debilitate you. And I think that's the trick. I mean, you know, how do you take, you know, look at what Tolle is preaching. You know, you've suffered enough. You don't have to suffer anymore. He's essentially implying in his writings that you have enough in reserve. You have enough in the human psyche. You don't need to create any more suffering. So all that you have left to do is to convert what suffering you do have. And self-love is what makes that possible. That conversion is actually possible in the, and being or having trust in your heart's conviction is the key piece to that. Absolutely.
Yeah. So once again, you know, another step on the journey of self-love, and we've got a lot more to come in this series, but I want to thank you, Ernie, for joining and bringing your wisdom and, you know, all that work that you've done in your life bring you to where you are and to be able to have so much to offer other people. And I just want you to briefly, if you could, tell people where they can find your radio show and your website, or just your website if your radio show is listed there.
Well, first of all, I want to say that it's a joy, Kaylee. I mean, I wish I could, you know, I told you a long time ago, I wish we could just do a show together. I think we do well together. But thank you for that. It's a joy always to be on your show. But no, my website is myname.com. That's ErnieBeccio.com. And on that site, you'll find Intentional Guided Evolution, which is a philosophy and a set of theories that I have put together, and counseling theories which is really the integration of all counseling models, all psychology and counseling models kind of come into this one model, which is called Gifted Compassionate Therapy. And so I teach people, first of all, how far off kilter they are on this business of compassion, and that if they want to be a gifted compassionate, how that process is made possible through intentional guided evolution, which those terms came out of my work with trauma patients who I found that something inside of them was pulling them into the present in spite of the ego's resistance to that. So I wanted to understand more and more what that something was, and so I teach people what it is, and so that's where you find me. And my show on Blog Talk and on Sedona is The Soul's Intent, which is really came out of a book I did a couple of years ago on a bunch of dream work I'd done with some of my patients. So thank you for
being here, Ernie. And once again, you can find Ernie at ErnieVecchio.com. That's Beccio.
Yes.
.com. Okay. And I know that you'll be back. I've had you on the show many times. So thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And stay tuned. I believe my next show is actually going to be next week. So join me next week. And you know, I just want to thank you. Have a really good evening, and we'll see you next time.